This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 18, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown.
Fallout from President Bush's energy plan continues. In Hanford, the administration looks to take a 20-year-old nuclear reactor off standby and put it back into action. Except for a well-timed egg at a politician, the British election campaign could use a little spicing up.
Not really been following it, to be honest, plus I can't really see who to vote for.
And progressives on Capitol Hill narrow their sights on the Pacifica crisis.
But first, these news headlines.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Perry. Israeli helicopter gunships fired missiles at Palestinian security headquarters in the West Bank today, hours after a suicide bomber killed six people at an Israeli shopping mall. The Voice of Palestine Radio reported that at least eight people have been killed by Israeli warplanes in the West Bank towns of Nablus and Ramallah. Earlier today, a Palestinian suicide bomber killed six people and himself and injured 110 others outside a crowded Israeli shopping mall in the deadliest such bomb attack since a Palestinian uprising began last year. Free Speech Radio News' Peretz Kidron says that Israeli leader Ariel Sharon was elected on a platform that he would prevent more bloodshed, and so far, that prediction has fallen flat.
We have to remember that Sharon was elected 3 months ago on specific pledges that he would be able to provide security. And so far, he's managed to provide nothing. The security situation is deteriorating. And more and more, his own supporters, the hardliners, are looking to him to deliver. And as the tactics he's adopted so far haven't yet produced results, he obviously has to raise the notch them up of a point or two.
That was correspondent Peretz Kidron in Jerusalem. President Bush spoke at a hydroelectric plant in Pennsylvania today, the day after he released his much-anticipated 163-page energy blueprint for the U.S. Critics of the plan have attacked the specifics, noting that the plan sets no targets for energy efficiency, offers no short-term relief for out-of-control electricity prices in the West, and provides only modest financing into clean energy technology. Yesterday, former President Jimmy Carter joined those critics. In an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, Carter attacked statements made by Vice President Dick Cheney that Carter's administration could ever conceive or ration our way out of an energy crisis. Carter wrote that he emphasized energy conservation and the increased production of oil, gas, coal, and solar energy. In his speech today, Bush gave out platitudes about conservation, but brought up the current electricity problems in California. The president said the state has been a leader in conservation efforts, but their situation proves his point that conservation alone isn't enough.
We all must be deeply concerned about our fellow citizens in the great state of California. But the problems in California shows that you cannot conserve your way to energy independence, that not only we need to have good conservation, but we must have a diversified base of supply.
Among the loudest critics of the president's plan is California Governor Gray Davis. Bush seemed to be referring to Davis when he assailed the politics of personal destruction.
You know, it seems like recently, those of us who used to not be in Washington, we'd be looking up there and seeing that people would rather argue than discuss. They'd rather call names rather than come up with solutions. They'd rather point fingers at people rather than holding out the hand of constructive dialogue. And it's got to change.
California officials say they're planning legal action against a number of electricity generators next month. They say state investigators have evidence that generators have been withholding power in order to drive up prices. From Sacramento, Free Speech Radio News' Joshua Chaffin reports.
California Public Utilities Commission President Loretta Lynch told the Los Angeles Times that a number of generating companies have been acting illegally as a cartel, coordinating to take power plants offline at times of peak demand. California Attorney General Bill Lockyer's office has been investigating allegations of unfair business practices since January. Lockyer has not released any details of that investigation. PUC President Lynch says the names of the generating companies in question and the details of her case against them will remain confidential pending legal action. A spokesman for an association of energy producers says the producers have done nothing illegal. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joshua Chaffin in Sacramento.
Offshore drilling opponents in Florida plan to boycott Chevron and Conoco retailers, but company officials say they'll only end up hurting independent service station owners. Gulf Coast Environmental Defense is the group spearheading anti-drilling efforts in the Florida Panhandle. It's organizing the statewide boycott. Chevron, Conoco, and Murphy Exploration are partners in a proposal to place the state's first natural gas production rigs some 25 miles south of Pensacola Beach. Chevron has 607 stations in Florida, but Conoco has only 7, all in the Panhandle section of the state. In both cases, all of these stations are independently owned and have franchise contracts with the company to sell their brands. Supporters say the boycott will show company executives that the anti-drilling movement is vigorous. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Perry.
Some public utilities in the Pacific Northwest seem skeptical about President Bush's plan to cure the energy crisis plaguing the West. The president's proposal calls for more oil and gas drilling on public lands, as well as more nuclear power plants to be built. A member of the Northwest Energy Coalition says the president's plan may help down the road, but doesn't do enough right now to cure the needs of the region. In central Washington state, a nuclear watchdog group is concerned that the Bush administration has lifted the permanent shutdown status on a breeder reactor on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham announced a 90-day delay in order to determine if there's enough private sector interest in restarting the reactor. From Hanford, Lira Bartish reports, some are balking at the idea of starting up the fast flux test facility, fearing it may lead to increased accidents and the creation of new nuclear waste streams.
The 20-year-old nuclear reactor at Hanford has been on hot standby since 1992. That's when Hanford's mission was refocused entirely on cleaning up one of the most toxic radioactive waste sites in the world. In the final days of his administration, President Clinton signed an executive order permanently shutting down the reactor, but President Bush has blocked the final closure and reopened the idea of restarting the reactor. Hyun Lee, an attorney with the Seattle-based nuclear watchdog group Heart of America Northwest, says continued standby status for the reactor is costing taxpayers $40 million a year.
$40 million a year that is drained from the cleanup budget that's meant to deal with Hanford's 177 high-level liquid nuclear waste tanks is being used to keep it on hot standby right now. It needs to be shut down so that that money can go to cleanup.
Reactor promoters are touting the fast flux test facility as a source of badly needed medical isotopes for cancer treatment and diagnosis. But Lee says one of the problems with breeder reactors like the FFTF is they tend to produce more plutonium-238 than they use. Lee says the U.S. shut down its breeder reactor program years ago precisely for that reason.
If you were producing plutonium-238, which is something they were considering, you would be bringing in some... I believe it's highly enriched nuclear fuel for the reactor. This would be very enticing to possible terrorists who would be interested in obtaining this material for their own purposes.
Lee also says since the fast flux test facility is a research reactor, not a production reactor, it would need a large amount of retooling, also raising the accident risk. And once restarted, the reactor could be used for new weapons production.
Unfortunately, the United States imports right now, for diagnostic purposes, over 95% of its medical isotopes.
Nuclear physicist Robert Shenter is retired from Westinghouse and sits on the boards of the Nuclear Medicine Research Council and the National Association of Cancer Patients. In his home near Hanford, Shenter outlines a growing need for medical isotopes, saying it's important that we don't have to pick and choose which patients to treat.
Especially when we get FDA approval, and you're talking about not 20 patients, not 40 patients. When you're talking about thousands of patients, which we have, there are over 1.5 million cancer patients, new cancer patients, every year. And we're going to need at least a reactor like FFTF to provide that.
Shenter says we're at the mercy of Canadians who produce much of the medical isotopes used in the U.S. He says threatened strikes in Canada have twice sent isotope users scrambling. Shenter says a new experimental form of cancer treatment called radioimmunotherapy shows great promise. He says current treatments like chemotherapy kill healthy cells along with the cancer cells.
The use of medical isotopes, it's a unique, especially in treatment, it is as a nuclear physicist, as a scientist, I can see the great advantage, because the only way you can deliver a lot of energy that is needed to kill these cancer cells is with these medical isotopes.
Shenter says 20 to 30 isotopes are now being used in over 100 clinical trials in the U.S. A number of companies and medical research facilities have expressed interest in using isotopes from the Fast Flux Test Facility. Those include a company in San Fernando, California, that wants to irradiate food, and companies that use isotopes for sterilizing medical instruments. Isotopes are already FDA approved for treating pain from bone cancer. But Hyun Lee of Heart of America Northwest says his group's review of letters sent to the DOE by potential contractors show no firm commitments to buy the isotopes. The Bush administration hopes to know by August whether or not a substantial market exists. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Richland, Washington.
While California narrowly averted more rolling blackouts this week, the state did not avoid another rate increase. California's Public Utility Commission imposed the largest electric rate increase for the state's residents in U.S. history. The rate increase will help to replenish the $6 billion the state has spent for power on the spot market since January. In response to the exorbitant rates wholesale generators have charged for power, California's governor created a state power authority, which he says will discipline the Western market. Cotta Mester reports from Sacramento.
It was the largest electric rate increase in U.S. history. Rates will go up as much as 37% to help the state recoup the nearly $6 billion it has spent on energy so far this year. Mindy Spatt is a spokesperson for TURN, the Utility Reform Network.
Residential consumers are bearing a larger share of, if you take a look at this chart right here, that's residential consumers, 22.1. Here's the large commercial down at 15.4. So I think that residential consumers have been given a rate increase that's completely unjustified.
The commission approved a tiered rate hike retroactive to March 27th, which will be spread over a 12-month period. Industrial rates will be capped at 49%, while the agricultural industry will see a maximum increase of 20%. State regulators are also warning that they might raise rates again if the wholesale price of energy continues to rise. California's Governor Gray Davis took an aggressive stance towards electricity generators, warning them that they must lower their prices and run their plants at full tilt to avoid retaliation from the state this summer.
I made it very clear to generators when I visited with them last week that the ball's in their court. If they don't act responsibly and do everything in their power to help us get through this summer, which means operating at full capacity, then I'll have no choice but to sign a windfall profits tax and to seize a plant. I made it very clear that their fate is in their own hands. They've not behaved well to date. This summer is the critical test. If they don't want to see their plants seized, they should make sure their plants are up and running this summer to get us through what everyone acknowledges will be a difficult period.
Davis made that statement as he signed a new statewide public power authority into law. The California Public Power Authority will oversee the construction of new power plants and will have the power to seize them if necessary. Davis says the Public Power Authority will serve as a safeguard against out-of-state generators, which he says have been manipulating the power market in California. While Democratic lawmakers applaud the power authority, progressive legislators and consumer advocates urge Governor Davis to take more immediate action and form what they call a buyer's cartel with the states of Oregon and Washington. The cartel would purchase power for the next 2 years at a set rate, which would include a reasonable profit for generators to be determined by the governor. Democratic Assemblymember Paul Kuritz.
By setting our own price cap, California is once again in the driver's seat. We can control our own destiny. We can stop the hemorrhaging. We'll help while we get new power plants up and running and await long-term contracts kicking in to stop this kind of gouging. We will pay these power generators a fair price, but we'll no longer allow them to make us their cash cows.
Supporters of the measure say the buyer's cartel would be too lucrative a market for wholesale power generators to lose. California, Oregon, and Washington make up 20% of the domestic power market. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Cutta Mester in Sacramento.
In Vancouver, British Columbia, this Wednesday, Justice David Tyso of the Supreme Court ruled partially in favor of the U.S. Metalclad Corporation against the Mexican government in an appeal to the Chapter 11 investor rights laws of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Metalclad took over a toxic waste treatment plant in Guadalajara, Mexico in 1995. The local municipality denied Metalclad a building permit for that plant. Metalclad built the $20 million plant while the governor of San Luis Potosi declared the area an ecological reserve. From Vancouver, Thatcher Collins reports.
Metalclad CEO Grant Kessler says its toxic waste facility would have had a positive effect on Mexico's natural environment. He says that's why it was endorsed by the federal government.
That is a fully permitted hazardous waste treatment, storage, and disposal facility. It's capable of handling about 360,000 tons of the most hazardous waste produced by Mexican industries. As we sit, Mexico produces about 10 million tons of hazardous waste a year. About a million of it is properly treated or taken care of, and 9 million tons goes into their environment. Mexico dumps into their environment waste oils equivalent to an Exxon Valdez spill every 30 days. And there are potential risks to spills and noise and dust and other inconveniences, which is why in most communities, you know, you have opposition. Nobody really wants one of these things next to them.
But as Mary Botari of Public Citizen in Washington, D.C. says, the real issue is democratic control of municipal political power.
The people who were most concerned about this case were completely shut out of the process. The concerns, the environmental concerns of the local community don't matter. Okay? The NAFTA panel didn't even look at that issue. Where will these plants be located and who gets to decide? I mean, these types of local construction permits and local siting laws and those kinds of things are very common policies in the United States and Mexico. And Metalclad did an end run around the local municipality.
Justice Tyso ruled that the Mexican municipality did not need a more rigid permit process in this particular case, defeating Metalclad's original argument against Mexico. But then the ecological zoning of Metalclad's property was defined by Tyso as expropriation, or a near seizure of the property. Tyso ruled Mexico must buy the unopened $20 million facility and property from Metalclad for $15.9 million plus interest. After Metalclad sued, claiming $90 million in damages under NAFTA, Mexico's federal government weighed in against the dump. Now, with no level of government support, Metalclad has left Mexico entirely. But Mexico loses twice, more untreated waste in the short run and less local regulatory power in the long run. For Free Speech Radio News at KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, I'm Thatcher Collins.
It took an egg to whip some life into the deadpan British election campaign. Earlier this week, Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott delivered a jab to the face of a heckler after being hit by a raw egg. Some observers note the left jab may be as close as this election will get to any excitement. Correspondent James Smoot reports the politics of both candidates are leaning towards the right, and voter enthusiasm is rather low.
What was seeming like a stage-managed spin campaign dove into the gutter on Wednesday when Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott got into a brawl with a gasoline tax protester. On camera, Prescott was hit in the ear with an egg and instantly punched his assailant in the jaw. A general brawl followed. The images have been all over the British press, and rather than hurting Labour, Prescott's pugilistics seem to have given Labour a lift. But despite the ad hoc boxing, this promises to be the most boring campaign in modern British history. Even though the candidates are vigorously bashing each other over taxes, the National Health Service, and joining the European single currency, apathy has swept the electorate. On the core issues of economic policy, it is hard to tell the difference between the candidates. All of them favour the free market. And aside from the slightly contentious issue of the euro, foreign policy issues have not been mentioned at all. Pundits are not talking about who is going to win the election, but how big the Labour victory is going to be. As one would expect, turnout is expected to be low. According to the Daily Telegraph, it will be the lowest election turnout since 1876. In interviews conducted with people on the street in London Wednesday, few people were willing to discuss the election at all, and no one I approached indicated that they would vote. Richard Glynn, a sales representative at Victoria Station, made his priorities clear. Do you intend to vote in this general election that's coming up?
No.
No? Why not?
I'm too busy. I just haven't got time, you know? But basically, I'm not going to vote because I don't think it makes any difference.
Even people who have some degree of support for the Labour government have no interest in voting. David Walker, a university student, is just sick of politicians.
Do you intend to vote in the general election that's coming up?
No, not really.
Yeah. Why not?
Not really been following it, to be honest. Plus, I can't really see who to vote for, to be honest. Quite a lot of my friends the same age feel the same way, you know. Right. Just sick and tired of hearing about the government on the telly because of it all, really.
Right. How do you think that the current government's done its job?
I think they've done a reasonable job. I think they've been all right. There's a lot they've wanted to change, so it's going to take a long time to do that.
While Prime Minister Tony Blair is often described as insincere and even smarmy, William Hague, the leader of the Conservatives, is even less popular. In a poll conducted on Monday by Channel 4 News, 48% of the people polled agreed with this statement: William Hague is a national joke. Hague's strategy is focused on Bush-style tax cuts to win votes. This has fallen flat. In poll data released Wednesday by the Guardian newspaper, a majority of voters responded that they would pay more taxes for improved public services. Charles Kennedy, the leader of the third party, the Liberal Democrats, has promised just that and has experienced a slight rise in support. But the general reaction to the election campaign has been yawns at best. Fortunately, the British electoral system allows only 1 month for campaigning. Elections take place on June 7th. For Free Speech Radio News, this is James Smoot in London.
On Capitol Hill Tuesday, the Congressional Progressive Caucus held a forum on the crisis at the Pacifica Foundation and the issue of citizen access to the airwaves. The caucus planned for the forum to include members of Pacifica management and the majority faction on the foundation's board of directors. But the day before the forum, Pacifica withdrew from participating, sending only a written statement. As a result, the forum was dominated by critics of Pacifica's present national board and management. They told caucus members about censorship, harassment, and mismanagement at Pacifica, and the threat they believe the network's present direction poses to dissident voices. Matt Martin has this report.
In March, Brooklyn Congressmember Major Owens had a personal run-in with the conflict at Pacifica Radio. As a guest on Building Bridges, a community and labor program on Pacifica's New York station WBAI, Owens was set to speak about firings and bannings of longtime staff members at the station, including the program director, the morning news host, and a union shop steward. But before he could begin, Owens was cut off the air by WBAI's interim general manager, Utrice Lead. The experience pulled Owens into the struggle over Pacifica, the nation's largest and oldest progressive radio network, and led him to call on the Progressive Caucus to hold a forum on Pacifica in the context of citizen access to the broadcast spectrum.
The six Pacifica stations are uniquely situated to fill a communications gap for a significant group of citizens who have no other vehicles for mass communications. Pacifica entities occupying precious radio spectrum space have a civic value too great to allow their capabilities to be wasted or trivialized.
Owens said the FCC and IRS had granted Pacifica special status, and he questioned whether its original mission of free speech community broadcasting was being followed by the network's management. Owens also read from a list of questions which had been submitted to Pacifica. The foundation's only representative at the hearing was Jennifer Spearman, executive assistant to Pacifica executive director Bessie Walsh. Spearman read from a written statement and said she was not authorized to answer questions. The statement did not respond to the caucus's questions, but instead focused on the prerogatives of Pacifica national management.
As an FCC licensee, Pacifica and Pacifica alone has the duty to manage the operation of all of its stations. Although Pacifica may delegate day-to-day functions to employees, it has ultimate responsibility for essential station functions such as personnel, programming, and finances.
The statement also said that throughout its history, there had been a tension within Pacifica between the needs of local communities and the network's national commitments. Tomas Moran, a member of the Pacifica National Board from the San Francisco Bay Area, who has been sharply critical of the foundation's policies, said Pacifica was betraying the standards of the progressive community which had built the network.
Indeed, the methods imposed on the stations do not draw from the progressive movements of the past, which used education and organizing to swell its numbers. Instead, they draw from commercial model, which rewards any change that demonstrates increased listenership. These changes rightfully came under criticism of the few listeners and staff who were aware of them. Management reacted by mandating compliance rather than examining the criticism. Dissent has been squashed.
Moran said that in 1999, Nicole Sawaya, the general manager of KPFA, Pacifica Station in Berkeley, California, was fired for asking for full financial accounting for the station she was supposed to be managing. Pacifica then instituted a gag rule against discussion of the firing and other internal matters on the air. Station personnel who did so were fired or banned. And when a range of programmers defied the gag rule, Pacifica sent in armed guards, took over the station, and locked out staff and community for more than 3 weeks. Mary Alice Williams, member of the local advisory board at Pacifica's Washington, D.C. station, WPFW, talked about censorship and mismanagement there.
It's a management that increasingly commits arbitrary and capricious actions against station personnel, both paid and volunteer. Increasingly insults and censors local and national guests invited to participate in local programming. Employs senior managing officials with little or no knowledge of radio station management, and most importantly, moves farther and farther away from the fundamental principles embodied in the Articles of Incorporation and bylaws written by the founding members of Pacifica.
There was one bombshell at the forum when Congressmember Owens announced the resignation of Michael Palmer from the Pacifica Board of Directors. Palmer, the foundation's treasurer, had been targeted by critics of the board since 1999, when an email he had sent to then-board chair Mary Frances Berry, which discussed the possible sale of KPFA or WBAI, was made public. Most recently, the Pacifica Campaign, a national effort to unseat the present board, announced a national day of action against Palmer's employer, commercial real estate giant C.B. Richard Ellis. In his letter of resignation, Palmer encouraged other board members to protect themselves from what he called the tactics employed by a small number of groups and individuals in opposition to the progressive message of the Pacifica Foundation. Palmer declined to comment for this story. In the hearing room, a cheer went up at the announcement of Palmer's resignation. But Pacifica board member Ken Ford said he's sorry to see him go.
I was sorry to hear that Michael has resigned. Michael has provided Pacifica Foundation with many years of valuable service, and his appearance and his intellect will be sorely missed.
Congressmember Barbara Lee, representing Oakland and Berkeley, closed the forum by calling for further hearings on the crisis at Pacifica.
The more I listen, the more I'm wondering with regard to really how at risk is free speech in this country, given what has taken place in the last few years. And I'm wondering if we wouldn't want to recommend to the Progressive Caucus to look at conducting maybe some field hearings in some of the cities that actually the Pacifica stations.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Martin.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike or call 510-287-551. That's 510-287-551. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Jay Pageant-Seekins is a technical producer. Thanks to Vanessa Tate for technical assistance. I'm Verna Avery Brown.